Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back discussing the Torah portions. This week we're looking at the portion Mishpatim, which goes from Exodus 21:1 to 24:18. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, you can go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll go ahead and get into discussing.
In Mishpatim, God begins to tell Moses the details of the Torah he is making for the people of Israel, with a large variety of commands, including various crimes and sins and their punishments, which Moses puts in writing and which Israel confirms as a covenant initiated with blood.
So this portion begins with God giving various judgments or ordinances or rules to the people of Israel to obey going forward. And the first rules that you give actually pertain to having Hebrew slaves. The first rule that God establishes for having a Hebrew slave is that you can actually only have a slave for 6 years. On the seventh year, you have to let your Hebrew slave go. So immediately, this is establishing that slaves have rights. So this is very different from the kind of slavery that the people of Israel were suffering under Egyptian rule, where they were slaves for 400 years. And it's also different from what a lot of Americans are familiar with slavery of black people in America.
Yeah, if a slave is struck by his master such that he's wounded, loses an eye or a limb or something, he gets to go free. And if the master deprives his slave of food or clothing, or if he deprives his female slave of marital rights, then he has to let the slave go. So the master actually has responsibilities to his slave. And if the slave is abused and the master doesn't fulfill those obligations,
then God says the slave has to go free, yeah.
And another thing about this slavery is it's the result of that slave being bought with a price. Mm. So this isn't like American slavery where people were just captured and sold. In fact, it says if you steal a man to sell him, then
that warrants the death penalty, yeah.
So these people were not stolen. These people were not taken, captured to be slaves. They were paid for their service, in a way. Not just paid for their service, paid for their life.
It's similar. We saw the concept back in Genesis when the people of Egypt didn't have any more money to buy food, and so they sold themselves into slavery to get food. Becoming a slave in this sense, it's a way of paying back what's owed. In fact, we'll see later in this portion, if you steal something and then you don't have the means to pay back what you stole, then you have to sell yourself. You become a slave. So this kind of slavery isn't a caste system where there are free men and there are slaves, and that's just how it is. These are people who have a debt to pay, and that debt is paid after 6 years.
But I think it's worth noting, at the end of the 6 years, the slave can choose between service and freedom. Why on earth would he choose the service when he could go free?
Well, there are two reasons listed here. So first off, if the master gives him his wife while he's a slave, then that wife belongs to the master. So if he goes free, his wife has to stay in his master's house. So he's leaving behind his wife and children. So he would stay a slave because he loves his wife and children. But also it says, I love my master. So not only does he love his family that he got while he was in service, but he loves the master who gave him that family.
It reminds me of some things that Paul says, where he says, we are slaves for we were bought with a price. We were bought by Messiah, so we belong to him.
Right.
Another thing that he says is, when we were slaves of the sin, we were free from righteousness.
And then, having been freed from the slavery of sin, we became slaves of righteousness.
Exactly. For this slave, he can choose to go free, just like we could choose to be free from righteousness. We can leave any time.
Technically, although we were bought, and that's a debt that can't be repaid. That's a debt that doesn't go away after 6 years.
That's true, but we can leave. But if we do that, then we're cutting ourselves off from our master and what our master provides. If we love our master, Yeshua, who bought us with a price, and if we love what he provides for us, which is righteousness and life, then we will stay with him. So the next thing I wanted to look at is a pair of commands here. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Mm. And then it says, whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. So I noticed these two things as both basically being applications of the fifth command to right. honor your father and mother. We talked about before how that was the first command with a promise. If you do it, your days will be long in the land.
And if you don't do it, your days will be very short in the land because you'll be
that's
dead.
That's what it's saying here. It's saying yeah. if you violate this command, it's the inverse.
Yeah.
If you violate this command by physically striking your parents or by cursing them, either way, your life is forfeit.
Right. It's also kind of a reflection on the sixth command, you shall not murder. Because like Yeshua pointed out, and we pointed this out in the previous video, but hating someone is basically just murdering them in your heart. You hate someone and then you murder them. So mm-hmm. hating them is the first step of murdering someone. And so God is saying when it comes to your father and mother, if you get to that first step of hating your father and mother, and you show that through physically assaulting your parents or by even cursing them with your mouth, if you do either of those things, you get the death penalty, which is what murder gets. We see that in this portion, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. So God is saying cursing or striking your parents is the same level of evil as actually killing someone.
Yeah, and I mean, it's showing the concept we've already talked about the physical actions paralleling heart conditions. These two commands are virtually the same. One is striking, though, and one is cursing.
Right.
So one is physical.
And one is verbal.
Yeah. One is a representation of your heart. Mm. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. So if you are speaking these curses, it's showing that your heart is in that same black state that results in striking your parents.
Yeah. Or killing your parents.
Or killing them. So this is a violation of one of the Ten Commandments. It warrants the death penalty.
Right. So going on from this concept where we're talking about basically murdering someone in your heart and getting the death penalty for it, the portion then goes on to talk more about what happens if you kill someone, what kind of penalties you get, or what kind of penalties you get for injuring someone. And we already mentioned that it says that if you strike a man and he dies, then the person who struck him needs to be put to death. So this is hearkening back to all the way back in Genesis 9:6, when it says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man will his blood be shed. A life for a life, essentially, is what it's saying.
Yeah, Genesis 9 said, whether man or beast, whoever kills a man,
God will require a reckoning for that.
Right, and so he actually confirms that here. Even if it's an ox or something that kills a man, you kill the ox.
Right, it speaks to the inherent value of a human life, because again, like Genesis 9 said, man was made in God's image. That's where that value comes from. And so it goes through various circumstances, some of which are accidental, some of which are on purpose. For if it's an accidental death, then God says that he'll actually provide a place to flee so that way you don't get killed. So technically, you could get killed, but if you flee to this place, then you'll be fine. The Torah will go into more detail about this later, so we'll wait to go into more detail about it then, too.
But whereas there's truly accidental death, on the other hand, there's negligence. Like we said, if an ox kills someone, you kill the ox. But if you knew that that ox had a habit of hurting people, it's your ox and you didn't do anything about it, you kill the ox
and the owner of the ox. Yeah.
The owner didn't kill anybody. Exactly. But by his negligence,
he caused someone to die.
He caused someone to die. Exactly. It shows that intention isn't everything. Even if you do something wrong out of negligence because you don't care, it's still your fault.
Yeah. It's a similar concept to what Yaakov or James talks about, where he says, to him who is knowing how to do good but is not doing it, it is sin to him. Yes, that's talking about not doing good versus this one is not preventing bad. So it's a little bit different, but it's the same concept that your inaction can be sin. Sin is not just what you do, it's what you don't do. If there's a right thing to do and you're not doing it, that is sin.
Absolutely. It says a little later in this portion, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. So God is saying you have an obligation to help people you see in need, even if they're people who hate you.
Right. Or you hate them.
So it's exactly along the lines of what you're saying. Your inaction is sin. Mm. It's in violation of God's orders. Because it's causing other people harm by your own inaction. If you're placed in a situation where you can prevent harm and you don't do that,
then you're guilty of the harm that's caused.
Exactly. Because if you had done things differently, it would never have happened.
And one more aspect of this discussion is that it also talks about what happens with unborn babies. It says that if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. If you strike a pregnant woman and then she gives birth prematurely, that in and of itself is a crime that needs to be paid back for. But if there's more to it than that, if you do more than just cause the baby to come prematurely, if you cause any kind of injury, then that needs to be paid back to the person who caused the injury. This means that if you cause the death of an unborn child, then that means you have to die. The same penalty that applies if you strike a man, then you have to die. If you strike a woman and the baby dies, you die. And this is also just the entire concept of eye for eye, tooth for tooth. This is a core aspect of Torah's justice, is if you do wrong to someone, that wrong gets done back to you.
Now, as for this concept of eye for eye and tooth for tooth, Yeshua expounds and offers an alternative perspective on this concept when he says, "You heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I say to you not to resist the evil, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And whoever is wanting to take you to trial and to take your shirt, let him also take your coat. And whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Be giving to him who asks something of you, and do not turn away him who is wanting to borrow from you." So it's a pretty well-known concept, turn the other cheek. And I think a lot of people perceive it as like overriding eye for eye and tooth for tooth, as if he's contradicting it somehow.
Which, in a way, he kind of is.
Kind of. But I feel like he's giving an alternative for a slightly different situation. He's saying, if someone wrongs you, don't repay them. Show kindness to those who wrong you. On the other hand, what the Torah is talking about here is the person who harms an unborn child, harming the innocent who can't defend themselves.
Right.
And so Moses is establishing the just and right punishment for the judges to demand.
The Torah is establishing what is just, and Yeshua is saying, show mercy.
Exactly.
This is saying, this is what is absolutely just. This is what is required for a crime. This is the payment. And Yeshua is saying, you don't have to exact that payment. In fact, he's encouraging them not to, because that's the merciful thing to do. You're going above and beyond.
Someone who hurts someone deserves to be hurt. Yeshua is saying, even if they deserve that, you don't have to give that to them. If they hurt you, you don't have to hurt them back. It's better to not.
In fact, that speaks to the concept of grace, or unmerited favor. Unmerited meaning not deserved, and favor meaning treating them well. Unmerited favor is when they deserve bad treatment and you give them good treatment instead. I mean, it says that Yeshua died for us while we were still sinners. Obviously, sinners don't deserve for someone to die for them, but Yeshua did it anyway. That's what unmerited favor is.
Exactly. Yeshua is exhorting us to show kindness to those who don't deserve it, to show forgiveness to those who don't deserve it, just as he did for us. In fact, he says, if we don't forgive others their missteps, the Father won't forgive our missteps. How can we expect Yeshua to cover us with his kindness when we won't extend that same kindness to others? Yes, it's true. These people deserve eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but we deserve it as well. And if it were applied to us by God, we would all be found
guilty.
Guilty. So if we don't want God to apply that to us, why on earth would we apply it to others? And again, that's different from this specific instance in the Torah when he's talking about when you're hurting a woman with child, or her baby.
Right. You're not exacting that because of wrong done to you. You're doing that because of wrong done to the innocent and helpless.
Yes.
And that's something that will also be talked about later in this portion, is defending the cause of the innocent and helpless and those who can't defend their own cause.
So the Torah is saying there's justice. There are tons of verses saying pursue justice. And God is saying this is what is just. But there's a distinction between justice and stretching that to avenging yourself.
Mm.
It's not good to avenge ourselves, but it is good to seek justice.
Yeah.
And so that's where the balance needs to be struck. It reminds me of some things that Paul says, where he says, if possible, so far as it is in you, be living in peace with all men, not avenging yourselves, loved ones, but give place to the wrath of God. As it has been written, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Mm. It's saying, it's not your place to avenge.
Mm.
It's God's place. And in this case, God was allocating it to the people of Israel,
right,
saying, do my justice. This is justice. Do it on my behalf. But doing the justice on God's behalf, because God appointed that to you, is completely different.
Then I feel wrong, so
yeah,
I will get back
at him. I will take justice for myself.
Right.
You should never try to take justice for yourself. Take justice because that's what's right in God's eyes.
Take justice for the sake of other people and for God's sake. Don't do it for your own sake.
So after talking about these various offenses which deal with killing people, he then moves on to talking about ones that result in damage of property or loss of property. The most obvious being theft.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of this is kind of exposition on the eighth command.
Do not steal.
That's pretty straightforward. But now he's giving specifics about it and about the punishments of it. If you steal something and you get caught, you don't just give it back. You have to pay extra. You have to pay double in some cases, or in other cases, as much as 4 or 5 times more than you originally stole. And so, again, it's showing this is a big deal. It's not enough to just make everything back to the way it was before, because you sinned.
You've wronged that person.
And so there's this restitution to make it up.
It's very interesting because this restitution acts kind of twofold. It punishes the one who is thieving, and it makes it up to the person who was stolen from. It's the righteous thing for both parties.
And this extends not only to purposeful theft. Once again, you can be guilty by way of negligence. If you let your animal out and it ruins your neighbor's crops, you're responsible.
Mm.
If you accidentally start a fire and it burns your neighbor's property,
you're responsible. If you dig a pit and you leave it uncovered, and your neighbor's animal falls into it, you're responsible.
If your ox gores your neighbor's ox, then actually, you're not guilty by negligence unless you knew the ox had a habit of doing that.
Right. It's the same thing for when an ox gored a person. The owner isn't guilty unless the ox was in a habit of it.
Yeah. There's a distinction between things you couldn't have foreseen or you had no way of knowing and things that you totally had full knowledge of.
And you chose to just leave it undealt with.
Yeah. That's negligence. But clearly, God takes stealing very seriously. And it goes so far as to say, basically, if you're caught in the act of stealing as you're trying to break into someone's home, your blood's on your own head. Your life is forfeit if that person ends up killing you.
Right.
While he wasn't as strict as he was with the violations for honor your father and mother and you shall not murder, if you violate, you shall not steal, and you die, that's nobody's fault
but yours.
That's on you, yes.
It's specifically, if you steal at night, it doesn't explain why, but it says if the sun has risen, then there is blood guiltiness for the person who killed the thief. Presumably, it's because the property owner couldn't see exactly what was going on. He was just defending what was his. And so the thief dies, that's on him. But if there's daylight, then the owner sees exactly what's going on. And so if he does kill that thief, then that is on the owner. So even for a blatant sinner, even for a criminal, their life still has meaning. Their life still has worth. It has value. And so God is protecting the life of a thief to an extent. He doesn't extend it super far. It's just if it's daytime. But most thievery happens at night. But still, God has that amount of mercy that he doesn't treat everything the same. It's not just any crime, death penalty immediately.
But for every theft and every act of negligence which results in a loss of property, it's that person's responsibility to make full restitution. You owe a debt for your wrongdoing. even if you're not the one who took the property, if you borrow something that belongs to your neighbor and you damage that, that's on you. Now, there's a very interesting particular case where a man gave his neighbor something to keep it safe and it got stolen. And the owner thinks that his neighbor stole it, that he gave it to his neighbor to keep it safe and his neighbor just
betrayed that trust, yeah.
And his neighbor flatly denies it. So actually, in this case, what it says to do is for both of them to come to God. In some translations, it says judges, because
the word Elohim
can mean either.
Yeah.
But like we already said, the judges are commissioned to serve for God's justice. Mm. So in a way, when you're coming to the judges of Israel, you are coming to those appointed as representatives of God's justice.
And it also goes on in a similar case. It says that they need to both take an oath before God that neither one wronged the other. So right. God is directly involved in all of this.
Yeah, and so it's showing, actually, the judgment. It says the one whom God condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. So that judgment, which comes from God, or maybe from God's judges, is the deciding factor. And it shows that's how justice is served, which means that they reach the just outcome. So it shows that God knows who's responsible. Right. Even if there's no proof, God knows. And so when they come to God for judgment, he delivers a just verdict.
So next we get to verse 16, which says, if a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. So this set of commands here, it demonstrates two basic things. The first thing is, if you sleep with a woman, she needs to be your wife. That is foundational to everything about marriage. But then the second thing that it establishes is that the father has the ultimate say in who his daughter marries. And in fact, the Torah here says that the father's decision trumps that if you sleep with a woman, she needs to be your wife. The decision of the father is the final, ultimate say in marriage. And what this really communicates is that premarital sex is wrong. If the father refuses to give her to you, then suddenly you've made a conflict where you were supposed to have her as your wife, and now it's broken. And so it's a form of adultery, really. It's not exactly the same, but it goes back to that same one of the Ten Commandments, you shall not commit adultery, because marriage is sacred. You're only supposed to have one woman. That's what we saw from the very beginning with Adam and Eve. And so if you wait until marriage to sleep with a woman, you'll never have that conflict between you slept with her, but her father says it's not okay. The right way to do it is ask the father for permission, marry her, and then go to her. That's the way that it should be. And God here is establishing what to do if you break that, if you've already violated that.
The command, you shall not commit adultery, like we've already talked about, it's establishing the sacredness of marriage. That's a pattern that was established from the beginning. So these commands are basically upholding that and helping to enforce that. Mm. It's saying, if the boundaries of marriage aren't being respected, make them be respected. Get right. married. This situation isn't right in the first place. Mm. But God is giving Moses a way to enforce the sanctity of marriage. Mm.
Basically, you've already violated it. Here's how you get back on track and make her an honest woman.
Exactly. So moving on from here, the commands kind of get a bit more general about not wronging people.
Yeah.
It says, you shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless.
Right.
On the one hand, there's talking about the sojourner. He says, pretty simply, treat sojourners well because you were sojourners. He's calling to their sense of empathy. You know what it's like to be a sojourner. Don't make it harder for them.
In fact, there's a later verse. It says, you yourselves know the feelings of a sojourner, for you were also sojourners in the land of Egypt. So God says, you know what it's like. You Jews were strangers and sojourners in a Gentile land. So when Gentiles come to sojourn with Israel, don't treat them badly.
But with the widows and the orphans, he kind of comes at it from the opposite direction, saying, if you do mistreat the widows and orphans,
then your family will be widows and orphans.
Your wives and your children will then have to empathize with the widows and orphans because they'll be widows and orphans.
This is an interesting one to me because this isn't God establishing what the penalty Israel needs to enforce is. This is God saying, I myself am going to enforce this penalty. I am going to kill you. He says, I will hear the cries of the widows and orphans. He listens to those people who are poor and low in society, really. God deeply cares for them. And when no one else is paying attention to them or caring about them or taking care of them, God takes care of them and God avenges them.
He even goes on to say about those who are poor that you need to treat them well, that you shouldn't take interest from them, and that you shouldn't take their cloak as a pledge for a loan. He's calling on the people of Israel not to abuse the poor. And he says, if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. So it's the same thing. He's telling the people of Israel, on the one hand, be compassionate. And on the other hand, he's saying, I am compassionate. And when I hear the cries of the helpless, I help them. I avenge them. My wrath burns against those who abuse the helpless and the needy.
If you want to be on the right side of things, you need to be compassionate and gracious. Because if you're not compassionate and gracious, then the compassionate and gracious God will be a wrathful, avenging God to you.
It's very interesting. A lot of people think somehow wrath and compassion are incompatible.
They're opposites. They're opposite sides of the same coin.
Yes. He's so angry. He's filled with such wrath because of his compassion. Because the injustice, the wrong done to people, makes them cry out to him and he hears.
This is the same thing that we saw with the Israelites in Egypt. They cried out to God and God came and he obliterated Egypt. He did massive plagues against Egypt because of his compassion and loving kindness and faithfulness to the people of Israel.
Well, go back even further. The very first murder, God said Abel's blood was crying to him from the ground. Every time a wrong is done, those who are wronged cry out for justice. And so the compassionate God cannot turn a blind eye. His compassion demands justice. And so in his righteous, compassionate wrath, he metes out judgment on those who are uncompassionate and unjust and who wrongly oppress the oppressed.
And what's even crazier is that in his compassion and wrath, he also shows mercy. In that sometimes he makes a way out where you deserve that wrath, but he puts that wrath somewhere else. That's what he did with Yeshua. We all deserve wrath for all of our wrongs done. We've done a bunch of wrong things. I can guarantee I've done a bunch of wrong things. I'm sure you have too. We all have. But Yeshua took that wrath upon himself. So God's wrath is done. His compassion is fulfilled in that wrath. And yet there's also mercy to us, and we can still come to him.
So as we've been talking, we already found some commands that were basically expounding on some of the Ten Commandments.
Right.
About honoring your parents, murder, about stealing, about adultery. Now we get to one talking about the Third Commandment. Now, when we were talking about the Third Commandment last portion, we were talking about how taking his name in vain or to emptiness had to do with dragging his reputation through the mud. And that's basically exactly what he's saying not to do here. When he says, you shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people.
Yeah, don't curse God. Right.
Cursing God is literally soiling his him and his name, and it has a death penalty. In fact, later on we'll see someone who does it gets killed. But what I found really interesting is that this command extends that, draws a parallel in saying, nor curse a ruler of your people. He's not saying reviling God is cursing a ruler of your people, but he is saying the two go hand in hand. And I think that has to do with what Paul says, let every soul be submitted to the higher authorities, for there is no authority except by God. Such that those who are resisting the authority are setting themselves against God's decree.
Right. By cursing the ruler of your people, you're essentially cursing God through that, essentially.
Right. God put that ruler in place. So if you are cursing the ruler, you're cursing God's choice. And you're cursing the one God appointed to enact his vengeance, his justice.
Now, that's not to say that every ruler does enact vengeance and justice.
There are
definitely unrighteous rulers. We've seen that multiple times in Scripture. There were tons of unrighteous kings of Judah and Israel and of other nations. Even in Yeshua and Paul's day, the leadership of Israel, like the priests who were leaders in Israel, they condemned Yeshua to death. And they even were trying to condemn Paul, and Paul ended up speaking against them for being so hypocritical and evil. But Paul didn't actually realize he was talking to the high priest, who was the authority that God put in place. And when they pointed out to Paul, "You're talking like that to the high priest?" Paul says, "I did not realize, because God says, don't curse God or curse a ruler of your people." So he was sorry when he cursed the high priest, when he realized it was the high priest, even though the high priest was being hypocritical and evil.
Yeah, I mean, people are people. They don't always do what's right. And sometimes it's necessary for us to obey God rather than men. But even so, it doesn't justify cursing the one God put in place.
Mm. So next in verse 31, it says, "You shall be holy men to me. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh torn to pieces in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs." So I wanted to point out this verse because this is the first Israel-specific dietary law. We saw all the way back in Genesis how God said to Noah and all of his descendants, you can't eat blood. But here we have one that's specifically for Israel. You can't eat flesh torn to pieces, specifically by beasts or something like that. The word for this concept in Hebrew is actually trefa, which is where the Yiddish word treif comes from. Treif meaning unkosher animals. So this is the first time that God is establishing this is meat that Israelis cannot eat. We'll see a lot more about that going forward. God will have a lot more commands about what Jews are allowed to eat or not allowed to eat. But the reason both later in the Torah and here is, you shall be holy men to me. These dietary laws that God made for Jews, for the people of Israel, are specifically to make Jews holy, which means they're set apart or separate. It's to make them different from all the other nations, specifically to be holy to God, to serve his purposes.
Now we get to another section where he's expounding on one of the Ten Commandments, essentially. Mm. Very straightforward, you shall not spread a false report. Mm. It's very parallel to...
You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's saying, you shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness.
So don't help out a bad guy by doing it. Like, don't just not bear false witness on your own behalf. Don't do it on someone else's behalf either.
If you bear false witness because someone else put you up to it, you're associating yourself with the wicked people. If you join the company of wicked people, what does that make you?
A wicked person.
But interestingly, there are some more situations in which you might bear false witness that Moses brings up. He also says, you shall not fall in with the many to do evil or bear witness in a lawsuit siding with the many so as to pervert justice. Now he's talking about peer pressure. Just because everyone else is pressuring and because everyone else is lying doesn't mean you should join in with their lie.
Right. This is specifically in the context of having a false report, but this also applies in everything else. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, just period. It doesn't matter what anyone else is doing. You have to be doing what's righteous.
And it's also telling them not to take bribes. So all of this is basically saying, don't let anything dissuade you from justice. Mm. Not money, not wicked people.
What's really interesting is there's one, it says, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute.
Yep.
That's not something that you hear very often, but saying you shouldn't even let pity for someone who's poor cause you to pervert justice. You can pervert justice on behalf of the rich because you're taking a bribe, or you can pervert it on behalf of the poor because you pity them. Both of those are wrong. It's a Torah concept, and it's also repeated in other places in Scripture. God has laid out a path for us, and we shouldn't turn aside to the right or to the left. You shouldn't be partial to a poor man or to a rich man. You shouldn't do it on behalf of yourself or behalf of someone else or on behalf of everyone else. You have to do what's righteous.
Yeah, just because something is the popular viewpoint doesn't make it the right viewpoint. Just because everyone says something is just doesn't make it just. Just because people are moved by pity and their emotions are manipulated to think something is just doesn't make it just.
God tells us what's just. That's exactly what this book is for.
Exactly. This book says what is just. God establishes what is just, and we have to measure it according to his standards, which are right here. So from here, God moves on to talking more about the calendar and special times that the people of Israel need to observe. And actually, the first one that he talks about is on a multi-year scale. He says, for 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow. So this is very interesting. He's saying you have a seven-year cycle going on. Mm. You work 6 years, and then the land rests in the seventh year.
Yeah.
And this is a parallel to what God's already established in the fourth commandment.
And which he then goes on to say in verse 12.
And which he repeats right here. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. And I find the emphasis really interesting in this passage. Because with the years, he says, you let the land rest that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beast of the field may eat. Mm. And with the Shabbat, he focuses on that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed. So both of these things, the Shabbat year and the Shabbat day,
are to help out the lowly among you.
Exactly. The Shabbat year is to provide food for those who don't have fields. You sow and you bring in your harvest every year.
Yeah.
This year
is for them.
Yeah. Just like that with the Shabbat day. Don't do your work on the seventh day. On the seventh day, you have rest so that your animals may have rest.
So that your servants can have rest.
Servants may be refreshed. So it goes along with some of the stuff we already talked about treating the lowly among you with compassion.
That's a common theme in the Torah.
And God is now basically mandating this is the time for them.
Right.
This is the time for compassion. Mm. And so it shows the Shabbat was made for man. Mm. And not man for the Shabbat. The Shabbat is not some rigid thing that we have to be bent over by. It was
made, on the contrary, it's made for freeing.
Our refreshment. It was made for compassion. It was made for goodness. And so it's lawful to do good on the Shabbat. If we use Shabbat as an excuse not to do good,
then we're missing the entire point.
We're completely missing the point. We're completely failing what Shabbat is about.
You have failed Shabbat. God then goes on to say, 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. So we already read previously that God established Passover and the Feast of Matzah as a feast. So that's the night of Passover, and then afterwards are 7 days. And during that time, you eat matzah, which is unleavened bread. No leavened bread anywhere. And so God starts out by just reiterating that. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, or matzah, for 7 days. And he says, none shall appear before me empty-handed. So this is a time when everyone is supposed to be bringing a sacrifice to God in the place where he chooses. We'll see later in scripture, that's Jerusalem at this point. But he also says that there are 2 other feasts. The Feast of Harvest and the Feast of Ingathering. These are more widely known as the Feast of Weeks, or Shavuot, and the Feast of Tabernacles, or Sukkot. He doesn't go into a lot of detail about them here, but he basically says the Feast of Harvest is a time for bringing in your first fruits. It's also called in Scripture Yom HaBikurim, which means the Day of First Fruits. And then for the Feast of Ingathering, or Sukkot, you're bringing in the last of your harvests, of your fruits and all that, that you're going to gather that year. And so each time you bring in a harvest or you're celebrating this feast, you need to appear before God. All the males in all of Israel appear before God, and they offer sacrifices, and they do it with matzah, and they bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of Adonai, your God. So God hasn't even established any rules for building a house of God yet, and yet he mentions it here. But basically, this is saying you need to bring sacrifices, and not just sacrifices, sacrifices from the first and best of everything that you produce that year, 3 times a year.
These 3 times are kind of like the center of Israeli society in the land, because they're the times that God is saying, all your men have to come up to appear before God.
Right.
So everyone is coming together.
Yeah.
I think some people call them the pilgrim feasts. That's not a word actually used here.
Right.
But it's because
everyone goes up to Jerusalem.
Yeah. Everyone takes that journey to come before God with presents after their harvests, after what they've brought in, and they're giving from that to God. So it's a time for celebrating all that God's done for you.
And thanking Him.
As a group, as a nation. Passover is about when you came out of Egypt. So you're remembering all that God did for you this year. You remember all that God did for the people of Israel as a nation. Mm. You just remember everything God did for you, and you celebrate it by giving to God.
So this is basically an introduction to Israel's calendar. And the Torah will go into a lot more detail about all three of these holy days in addition to other holy days. So we'll discuss these more when we get there. So everything that we've read in this portion so far has been God telling Israel what they need to do. Now we get to the part of the portion where God starts saying what He is going to do for the people of Israel. And He starts out by saying He's going to send His messenger or His angel ahead of the people of Israel to help bring them into the promised land, the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Canaanites, and all those guys. He says that He'll be speaking through this angel. And so the people of Israel need to listen to this angel because they need to listen to God. He says, if you truly obey His voice, the angel's voice, and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. So God here is making a really conditional, clear-cut thing. If you obey me, I will be an enemy of your enemies.
God is absolutely promising that the angel that He's sending is going to bring them to the promised land. Mm. And when they get there, He's going to blot out the inhabitants who live there.
And He makes other promises too, that there will be no miscarriages, that there will be no barrenness in the land, that they'll be fruitful and take possession of the land. But He specifically says, if you obey God.
And as He's promising, I'm going to drive out these nations, I'm going to plant you in this land, He accompanies that with a warning. And the warning is, when I drive them out, don't bow down to their gods, don't serve their gods.
And don't even let the Canaanites and all those other peoples stay in the land.
Yeah, don't leave them, don't make a covenant with them, definitely don't make a covenant with their gods.
Right, because they'll lead you into sin.
He also says, make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips. He's really saying, distance yourself from their gods. I'm about to send you into a land with a bunch of other gods. Distance yourself from them, destroy them, don't let them in.
Have no partnership with them. It's similar to what Paul says about not being unequally yoked with unbelievers. And where it also says in the Torah, and Paul will also quote this, purge the evil from among yourselves. And he says, evil associations corrupt good character. If you allow evil to dwell in your midst and accept it, then it will influence you and turn you away from God and turn you into sin. And so God is saying, kill all the Canaanites, purge them from the land, destroy their gods. Don't let anything remain.
After all the commands He's already given, expounding on the commands He's already given, now He's expounding on the second command. You'll have no gods before me. Now He's saying, when you go there, there will be other gods. Don't have them before me. Do not serve them. Get them out. If you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So all this stuff, everything He's commanded up to this point, is all guiding them to live the right way. Mm. It's all establishing His justice. It's all expounding on His commands and telling them how they can keep them. And now that He's saying, if you leave those gods in the land, if you make a covenant with those people, right there, you'll be tripped up. Mm. Right there, it will snare you and keep you from everything else. Yeah, everything else I've said will be ruined if you...
Exactly.
Serve these gods.
And it's more than just a matter of God deserves all the glory and honor and worship. What's the first commandment? I am Adonai, your God. And that's what He based everything else on. All of this justice that He's laid out and all of these other commands, those come from the fact that they're serving Adonai, the just God. And so if they're serving a different God, then everything else about their morality will crumble. The foundation of all morality and all justice and all righteousness is following God, the God of Israel. If you serve another God, everything else falls apart.
So at this point, God's basically given all the instructions for now. God sends Moses down. He says, these are what you're supposed to tell the people of Israel. After you do that, come back up with Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. So he's bringing 70 people to worship God from afar.
Mm.
So only Moses is allowed to come near, but the others are allowed to come up. And so with that, Moses goes down. He tells them, these are the rules. And so the people answer with one voice and say, all the words that Adonai has spoken, we will do. So they already said this before the Ten Commandments. Before the Ten Commandments, they said it, and God's like, I'm going to come down so I can make my covenant. He said those Ten Commandments, and then the people said,
we don't want to hear any more commands. Right. Moses, you get them and tell them to us.
Right. So these are the rest of the words of the covenant that God just told Moses, and Moses told them to the people of Israel. And so now Israel has heard all the words of that covenant and said,
yep,
we'll do it.
We're still sure we are going to keep these.
And so then Moses is like, okay, let's put it in writing. So he writes it all down. He makes a book of the covenant. It's like a contract.
Yeah. And this is the first time that God has given instructions to Moses and he's written it down. This is the writing of the Torah. Not all the Torah, but this is the writing of the Torah right here, right now. This is accompanied by, he then reads from the book. So he's already said it verbally. Now he's reading it from the book as it's written. And they again say, we'll obey all that God says. And so then Moses takes some sacrifices. He kills the sacrifices. He collects the blood and he sprinkles that blood on the altar that he's made and toward the people. And he says, behold the blood of the covenant, which Adonai has made with you in accordance with all these words. So we've already talked about how in everything that we've read in this portion, it's laid out what God has expected of the people and what the people can expect God will do if they obey him. So this is a two-way contract, and they put it in writing and then they've sealed it with blood. Now, I want to point out this term of the blood of the covenant, this is not the only place where that term is used. The Master Yeshua also used this at his last Passover. We mentioned this in a previous portion, but Yeshua said, this is the blood of the covenant, my blood of the covenant, which is being poured out for you for release from sins. Basically, Yeshua is saying, just like how Moses here is giving sacrifices and sealing the covenant of Torah with blood, Yeshua is sealing the new covenant, which Jeremiah talks about in Jeremiah 31. Yeshua is sealing that with his own blood. This is a covenant where the people of Israel need to obey God and be his people. The new covenant is a covenant where Yeshua is cleansing people and releasing their sins. And so we see that in both cases, Moses and Yeshua are the ones initiating this covenant. They're the ones who are sacrificing these sacrifices, because Yeshua isn't just a sacrifice. He's the priest who's bringing the offering. And so Moses and Yeshua are doing exactly the same thing here. And it's in this way that Yeshua is a prophet like Moses. The Torah came through Moses, but unmerited favor and truth came through Yeshua. And so this is a really clear picture of showing what a prophet like Moses needs to do, which is establish a covenant with Israel.
Establish a covenant with Israel with blood.
Mm.
This blood is a crucial part of what starts the covenant.
Absolutely.
The author of Hebrews harkens back to this event when he says, not even the Brit Rishonah, the first covenant, was initiated apart from blood. And in the same way, it was necessary for the pattern of the things in the heavens to be purified with these sacrifices, and for the heavenly things themselves to be purified with sacrifices better than these. Yeshua's blood made the new covenant possible in the same way that this blood sealed the first covenant. And where there's blood, there must be a sacrifice.
Mm.
If Yeshua had not been sacrificed for all of us, the new covenant which God promised to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah could never have come to pass. That's not to say that the new covenant is apart from Torah.
It was sanctioned by Torah.
The new covenant was sanctioned by Torah, and it was to write the Torah on the hearts of the people of Israel.
Absolutely.
What Moses did here was he wrote the Torah. He wrote it down in a book, and then through the blood, he enjoined that covenant to the people of Israel.
Mm. And then Yeshua
took the Torah and wrote it on our hearts, and by his blood, he enjoined that covenant to us.
Mm.
He brought us into that covenant. And so after Moses ratifies the covenant, he takes Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they go up and they see the God of Israel. Now, this is really interesting because before there was a barrier, And they were told, you can't come up. If you touch the mountain, you'll die. But now God is inviting them up where they can see God. And it specifically says he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. So what's different?
They've been sprinkled by the blood. It says Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant. When they're sprinkled with the blood, that's when they can come near to God.
Just as Yeshua's blood covers us so that we can come near unhindered to the throne of unmerited favor. Now, after this, God says to Moses, come up closer. Everyone else is supposed to stay afar, but God says, Moses, come closer. So I can tell you the rest of my commands. I may give you the tablets of stone with the Torah and the mitzvah, which I have written for their instruction. God is basically saying, we've made the covenant. Now I'm going to give you the Torah, and it's going to be written in my own hand.
God's already given Moses commands, and Moses has written them down. And now God's saying, here's my handwritten copy.
Yep. So Moses comes up closer, and he says to everyone else, wait here. If you have a problem, talk to Aaron. I'm going to God. I could be a while. And he is a while.
He's see you in 40 days.
He didn't know how long he was going to be, but it says he went into the cloud.
The cloud of God's glory.
So they couldn't see him. He was completely covered. The whole mountain was covered.
In cloud and fire and lightning.
So they were seeing the glory, but they didn't know where Moses was. Moses was receiving the Torah of God for 40 days and 40 nights. So out of all these commands, the central takeaway I would draw is that violations of commands have penalties. The penalty varies depending on the command, but it's always something is owed as a result of your wrongdoing. If you steal, you have to give back and then some.
Right.
If you kill, your life is forfeit. A whole lot of things, your life is forfeit. Because wrongdoing is a very serious matter. Violating God's commands comes with a price. But Yeshua paid that price for us. Without Yeshua, we would all be so guilty we could never repay our debt. But Yeshua repaid that debt in full by buying us such that we're like those slaves who certainly weren't stolen. They rightfully belong to their master.
Right.
And so it's our job to decide, do we love our master? Do we love that he provides the payment for our violations? Or do we want to go our own way and try to come up with that payment ourselves?
See how that turns out.
So remember that your sins have a payment, and thank God and follow him and love your master for paying that debt for you.
That wraps up the portion of Mishpatim. Next week, we'll be looking at the portion of Terumah. So be sure to tune in for that. Thanks again for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.